You're listening to Admitting Diagnosis, the Journal Watch podcast for January 23rd. I'm Joe Elia. We offer news and an interview. This week's interview is about an increase in MRSA found in head and neck infections in children. But first, here are the week's other top medical headlines. First, steroids and wheezing kids. Second, antidepressants and fibromyalgia. And third, MRSA itself. Details. The treatment of young children under age 6 who have wheezing caused by viral infections is certain to change as a result of two articles published this week in NEJM. One study preemptively administered daily high-dose fluticasone, or placebo, to children at the first sign of any upper respiratory tract infection for up to 10 days. After almost a year of observation, the kids getting fluticasone required less treatment with rescue corticosteroids, but they showed some evidence of growth retardation. The second study randomized kids with viral-induced wheezing either to placebo or to oral prednisolone. All initially got albuterol. The duration of hospital stay did not differ between the groups. An editorialist says that the preemptive treatment's side effects are too worrisome to adopt it into practice until we get more data. And he recommends that kids get prednisolone only when they are hospitalized and severely ill. Next, fibromyalgia responds well to small doses of tricyclic antidepressants, according to a meta-analysis published in JAMA. The drugs had large effect sizes on pain, fatigue, and sleep problems. Writing in Journal Watch General Medicine, Thomas Schwenk observes that the class of antidepressants currently approved for use in fibromyalgia had the smallest effect of all the classes examined. Our final story this week is the subject of our interview, which is next. We talk with Dr. Stephen Sobol about his paper on MRSA in pediatric head and neck infections. Here we go. This month's edition of the Archives of Otolaryngology, Head and Neck Surgery carries a brief article on national trends in pediatric head and neck infections caused by Staph aureus. The authors used a national database, the Surveillance Network, which tracks antimicrobial resistance in more than 300 hospitals, to examine 6 years of data in children, from 2001 to the end of 2006. Over the six-year period, a total of 21,000 head and neck infections with Staph aureus occurred, of which 21% were methicillin-resistant infections, so-called MRSA. The rate climbed over the interval, starting out at about 12% in 2001 and ending up at 28% in 2005, a gain of 16 percentage points. We've asked one of the authors of the paper, Dr. Stephen Sobol, to talk with us about its implications for patient care. Dr. Sobol is a surgeon in the Department of Pediatric Otolaryngology at Emory University in Atlanta. Thanks for talking with us today, Dr. Sobol.
You're welcome. Thanks, Joe.
I hope you won't mind, but your abstract notes a high occurrence, about 20% in the east-north-central region of the U.S. That's Wisconsin, Illinois, Michigan, Ohio, and Indiana. But the text says the difference occurs because of unequal hospital participation in the network. Which is it?
That's a very good question, and one of the morals of the story that I want everybody to take home is that this is not a population-based study. The Surveillance Network is a peer-reviewed organization that collects microbiologic data directly from the databases of hospitals that participate in the network. Now, depending on the region of the country, some regions are going to have a larger representation of hospitals and outpatient centers in the network, whereas other regions are going to have less representation.
Okay.
So this is a based study.
All right. So people in those states should not be alarmed at the, nor should the people in New England or in the mountain states feel virtuous because their rates were, they found well under 10%, right? So
correct.
So
the, this study follows a trend over time.
Okay.
The importance of the study is it comes in tracking those same institutions from 2001 time point to the 2006.
Okay.
In other words, that assumes that makes the assumption that data collection capabilities of the surveillance network were equal in 2001 with those institutions as they are in 2006, which is one of the assumptions we make when we analyze that database.
Okay. So it sounds like the work to determine if one wanted to do that, which regions of the country were most at risk, still needs to be done.
Correct.
Okay. MRSA seems to be changing, according to the numbers that you found, from something that used to be nosocomial, which is hospital-acquired or healthcare-acquired, to something that's community-acquired now. Is that right? Is about equal parts?
Based on a number of studies that have come out, particularly one in emerging diseases, there's been clear evidence that there has been an increased prevalence of community-acquired infection, community-acquired MRSA in recent years. Now, in our study, we used as an indirect measure of this specimens that were acquired in the outpatient setting versus the inpatient setting, and we used that arbitrarily as an indirect measure of what we presume would be community-acquired and versus hospital-acquired. Now, of course, that makes a supposition. For example, some of the samples that were collected on the outpatient setting very well come from a patient who happened to have the culture taken at an outpatient setting, even though they may have been in the hospital within a period of time that would have technically qualified them to have a hospital-acquired MRSA.
Okay.
Now, the definition of community and hospital-acquired MRSA is at best controversial, and I think those definitions are starting to blur in recent years as we see this emerging.
Okay. The character of what you've called community-acquired infections or those that were acquired in the outpatient setting or samples acquired in the outpatient setting, those are becoming less susceptible to clindamycin and therefore more dangerous, aren't they?
Yeah, I think it's important to look at it as MRSA because our study cannot, break it down into community and hospital acquired with any definitive statement.
Okay.
But overall, if we use our assumptions and our assumptions are reflective, then it seems to be that the percentage of clindamycin resistance seems to be going up in those strains that were probably susceptible to it previously.
In all of this, what do you hope that clinicians will take away from this, from your findings? What's the best thing that they can do to try to protect their patients and themselves from these infections?
I think, first and foremost, the importance of the study is just to make pediatricians and the public aware that the entity exists and that it is sometimes seen in something other than skin infections. We always think of MRSA, whenever we think of MRSA, we think of skin infections. However, this study hopes to bring to the attention of pediatricians particularly and general practitioners that you will see these occasionally in the ear, nose, and throat arena. Now, it's important to note that the first message to pediatricians is, and to the public, is don't panic. We know that this has been around at least for the past 10 years, if not more. And we also know from our data that it seems to have been that the percentage of resistant isolates seems to have been up for at least several years now. And yet we have not seen a publication of studies that have demonstrated a epidemic per se.
Okay.
So take-home message number one is don't panic and continue to follow current treatment guidelines that represent the best practice when you're dealing with children who have ear, nose, and throat problems.
Okay.
The second message is now that this has been brought to the attention of the primary care physicians as well as pediatricians, it's important to recognize that when those current best practice treatment plans are not working, that's when you have to start thinking about resistant organisms, including MRSA as one of them, and start to evaluate for those. That might mean obtaining cultures when appropriate from patients who don't seem to be behaving in a way that would be reflective of the treatment that they're getting.
Okay. And probably the... I'm sorry, go ahead.
The second question you asked, the second question that you asked was how what can you do to prevent and protect? I think common sense measures still prevail. As with any infection, we all know the old adage that you need to wash your hands between seeing patients. There are currently, at least in the hospital setting and in most outpatient settings, alcohol-based rubs that are used fairly effectively to reduce bacterial colonization, to prevent the direct skin-to-skin contact, which is responsible for staph transmission. Parents can also take home a secondary message, I think, which is, again, to me, reflects common sense, which is if your child is in a setting where there are sick children, you want to try to avoid those situations as much as possible. If your child is ill, they probably shouldn't be playing with other kids. And certainly you want to, even at young ages, start getting your kids to use alcohol-based rubs when they've been in public places and they've touched a lot of things, or to wash their hands frequently. A third take-home message would be, again, if there's an open sore, and to cover it. Don't expose it to other people, and try to avoid touching the open sores of somebody who has a skin infection.
All right, Dr. Sobel, that's great advice, and advice for everybody. Thank you so much for your time with us today.
You're very welcome, Joe.
Finally this week, an identity crisis. We're not so sure after 26 or so editions of this thing that we want to continue calling it admitting diagnosis, which some people have warned me sounds too much like an academic's game. If you listened to a few of these, it's clear that we're not pandering to the academy. What's your advice? If you've got a good alternate title, send it along to me at jelia, that's J-E-L-I-A, at nejm.org. Thanks for your suggestions. Have a great week of healing. And if you want to comment or complain, call 617-440-4374. If you'd like links for any of the stories or access to any of our other interviews, go to podcasts.jwatch.org. Our executive producer is Adoriano, and I'm Joe Elia. We'll see you next week. Thanks again for listening to Admitting Diagnosis, or whatever you want to call it.